Today I'm going to be reading from Mark 9, 2 to 13. Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And they appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, "Why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him."
Good morning.
All right.
Okay.
Wow, this is fun.
So we're in our trek through the Gospel of Mark, and we come to this very well-known passage, the Transfiguration. Jesus here takes three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, and he leads them up a high mountain. So we've seen, as we've gone through Mark, Jesus has disciples. He has large crowds of them that follow him around. At one point, we hear that he has 70. And then he's got the 12. And then he has the three, Peter, James, and John. So this would be Jesus' inner circle. These are the guys that were back in chapter 1. They're the first people that Jesus called to be his disciples. These were the only ones that were allowed of the disciples into the room when he raised Jairus' daughter from the dead. And now these are the three that get to make this trek up the mountains. Scholars aren't exactly sure where this mountain is. It's a high mountain. Some people think it's Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon straddles the border between present-day Syria and Lebanon, and it's right in the region of Caesarea Philippi, which is why, if you remember, that's where Peter makes his great confession. And so that's why people think this is likely, as possibly could be the mountain. Do you want to show that first picture of Mount Hermon? Okay. This is Mount Hermon. It's very unlikely that skiing was happening back then, or that the ski lift was an option to get to the top. But that is Mount Hermon. Here's another picture of Mount Hermon. So this is probably a little bit more like we might imagine, 9,232 feet above sea level. To give you a little perspective, if you've been out on the East Coast and been in the mountains on the East Coast, the highest mountain on the East Coast is Mount Mitchell in North Carolina, 6,684 feet, which means you'd have to go pretty far out west to finally hit a mountain that was 9,000 feet. So this would have been a pretty decent climb that Jesus and the disciples made to get to the top. All right, thanks, Ron. Mountains are important to Jesus and his ministry. It's on a mountain that he goes off and prays by himself. In Matthew's gospel, he gives his most famous sermon on a mountain, the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is tempted by the devil on a mountain. He'll be killed on a mountain, Golgotha. And after the resurrection, Jesus will actually send his disciples out into mission from a mountain. So mountains are important in the Bible because this is the place that people understood that encounters between God and humans happened, where God would reveal God's self to people. I read in one place that high mountains were seen as the suburbs of heaven, which again in my mind confirms why mountains will always, always, always trump the beach. I've never heard that about a beach in Florida. Mark tells us that they're headed out on this excursion after 6 days. So interesting, Mark, if you've noticed, as we've been going through Mark, he never tells us this, a specific chronological day like this. Usually it's immediately or something like that. So we should see this, we should stop. What is the significance that Mark is telling us it was after 6 days? Well, back in Exodus, probably the most famous encounter on a mountain to this point in the Bible took place on Mount Sinai in the book of Exodus. You're likely familiar with that story. God calls Moses to go up on the mountain so that he can give Moses the tablets of stone that have the law and the commandments on them. So Moses, if you remember, goes up on the mountain. A cloud covers the mountain, and then it's 6 days. It's almost like there's this 6 days of preparation for Moses to then have this encounter with God. So again, between what we assume is the great confession of Peter that Jesus is the Messiah, and now this Mount of Transfiguration scene, there's 6 days. There's these echoes that Mark wants us to hear between this most seminal event in Israel's history and what's about to happen here. There he was transfigured before them. Notice how, I want you to notice, if you're following along, that he was transfigured before them. So the them is referring to Peter, James, and John. And pretty soon Elijah and Moses are going to show up on this scene, and we're going to read that it's before them. And then at the climactic moment of this scene, a voice from the cloud will come and address them. This is important because this indicates that this is primarily happening for the benefit of the disciples. It's happening for them. Verse 3, his clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. So we have this scene of dazzling glory. If it's as if for a moment the veil has been temporarily pulled back, lifted, Jesus' glory is on full display in a way that God's glory was on full display on Mount Sinai. If you remember when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai, his face is so radiant that he actually has to cover it up. People are afraid to come near him. But that was a reflection of God's glory. It wasn't the source of God's glory. So now we have this glory emanating from Jesus. Jesus is the source. His clothes become dazzling white. So we read that they're whiter than anyone could possibly bleach them. In the Bible, white garments, brilliantly white garments, were signs of heavenly beings. And then all of a sudden, Elijah and Moses show up. So it's the three disciples and Jesus and Elijah and Moses. So these are in the Old Testament, in the imagination, these are the two probably greatest heroes of the Old Testament. And Peter says to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. So a little surprising, he addresses him as Rabbi. He just confessed him as the Messiah in our last passage. And now he's seen this dazzling transfiguration happen before him, and yet he chooses the title rabbi. A little surprising. But Mark does something he almost never does. He gives you an editorial comment. He says that that Peter didn't know what he was saying. He was so frightened. There's an old saying, maybe you've heard it, there are two kinds of speakers. Those who have something to say and those who have to say something. Peter seems to be the latter. He just has to say something, even though it'd be better if he probably kept his mouth shut. This week is Thanksgiving. You might have someone who often shows up at your Thanksgiving table that just can't help but blurt out the one thing that you don't want them to say. This is a good year for you, because you should be having your Thanksgiving over Zoom and you just mute them. You never can do that in real life. You can't like go to Uncle Mike and mute him. But I hope there's not literally an Uncle Mike in here, but you can do it. it's not even really clear what Peter's talking about. So there's lots of speculation. Was this a reference to the Feast of Tabernacles? Was Peter wanting to set up some kind of messianic headquarters on the top of this mountain? We don't know. One of the suggestions that I was really interested in by the commentators on this was that that Peter was trying to capture the moment, that he was trying to prolong this incredible scene that was happening on this high mountain. If this happened today, I could see Peter being like, wait, hold on. Elijah, you stay there. Moses, Jesus, don't change anything. I'm going to grab my phone. I want to capture this moment. So I've climbed a fair number of mountains in my life, and I often, when I get to the top of the mountain, I have this feeling that I want to preserve the moment. I realize that it's a spectacular moment, it's a spectacular view. In a few hours, I'll have descended that peak, be down in the valley. Oftentimes, I'm climbing mountains on my vacation, and I realize that within days, I'll be back in my office doing work far from this mountaintop. So I want to take it in. I want to sear it onto my mind. I want to preserve it. I want to hold on to it. We call these mountaintop experiences, right? We call them mountaintop experiences for a reason. It feels good to be on top of mountains. I would guess that most of us, even if you don't like climbing mountains, have come to moments in your life where you think, I don't want this moment to end. I just want to hold on to this moment. I want to hold on to it in my mind. I don't want it to end. I want to prolong it. I want to preserve it. So think about Peter. Not long ago, just a couple years ago, he was a fisherman. You know, the most exciting thing that's going to happen to Peter is probably a big haul of fish, which would be cool, but nothing like this. He's up on the mountain with this person he's confessed as the Messiah, the long-awaited Messiah. He's dazzling in front of him in glory. And there's Moses and Elijah. As I said, these are the two heroes of the Old Testament. Peter understandably wants to prolong this moment. He wants to prolong the experience of glory, not realizing that it can only be glimpsed. Not realizing that he's only getting a taste. Not realizing that there's not going to be a permanent construction project on this mountain. No, Peter, he can't prolong the moment. And not only that, he's actually misunderstood the moment. See, Peter thinks that this is such a great moment because these three great figures are now up on the mountain. Jesus, and Elijah, and Moses. And they're all equally great. But rather than to distinguish Jesus, to put him in this company, what's actually happening is the scene is setting Jesus apart. As Moses and Elijah are great, no doubt. But they do not share in God's glory in this way. They are only preparers for this. Only Jesus will fulfill God's purposes for Israel and for all humankind. And as we're going to see, Elijah and Moses soon vanish. They're gone. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. So this is the climactic moment of the transfiguration. A cloud covers them. I think definitely a more literal translation, I think a better translation is a cloud overshadowed them. This word overshadow in Greek is hardly ever used in the Bible. It's just a couple times. Exodus 40 to describe the cloud that filled the tabernacle with the glory of God. And then one, apart from the transfiguration scenes, there's one other part in the Gospels where we hear this word overshadow. Anybody come to mind? Anybody think about it? We're coming up on the season where we might read this text, right? In Luke's gospel, we read about an angel who comes to Mary and tells her that the power of the Most High will overshadow her. So this is a powerful word. This cloud represents the divine presence of the Lord, but in a way, as one person put it, it symbolizes the impregnating presence of God. God's presence is not going to dwell in a tent as the tabernacle of old, but actually in a human body, as the gospel writer John will most clearly lay out. A voice then comes from the cloud and says, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." This pronouncement should ring a bell. It sounds very similar to the pronouncement we heard back in chapter 1 at Jesus' baptism. The big difference is that was, as far as we can tell, that was only directed towards Jesus. This one, though, is clearly directed to the disciples. It's for their benefit. It again distinguishes Jesus from Elijah and Moses and gives Peter an idea that, yeah, he's on target with this confession. And then there's this command, listen to him. So it's interesting. There's all these spectacular visual effects happening on this mountain. So Jesus' robe is dazzling white. Elijah and Moses have shown up. There's this cloud that's come over the mountain. And yet the voice from the cloud doesn't say, look. It says, listen. Listen to him. You know, back in chapter 4, when we read the parable of the sower, Jesus said, whoever has ears to hear, let him hear. Now the voice from heaven is saying, listen to him. Open your ears to what he has to say. As spectacular as this is, you're going to need to listen. Listen to what? What's kind of strange is that Jesus has not spoken this entire time. So listen to what? Let's keep reading. Jesus and his disciples start to descend the mountain, and now Jesus finally begins to talk. He commands them not to share what they saw. We're kind of, as we've gone through Mark, we're familiar now with this command to silence. It often puzzles us. This is the one time in Mark it's provisional, so the disciples can talk about this, but not right now. They have to wait until after Jesus has risen from the dead. So let's think about this. Why doesn't Jesus want them to share this? It's because Jesus knows the only way the disciples are going to understand this moment, understand what happened on the mount, is post-resurrection, is after Jesus has been killed and raised, and now they get to look at this through the lens of the cross. See, Jesus hasn't suffered. He hasn't been humiliated at this point. At this point, they've seen the power and the miracles. They've seen this display of glory. They haven't seen the suffering, the humiliation that Jesus has told them is going to come. Jesus says, you're going to have to wait until that. Disciples don't get it. Remember, Jesus, back in our last passage, Jesus talks about suffering and dying. What does Peter do? He pulls him aside and rebukes him. So this is a little bit more restrained. Peter's probably kind of learned his lesson here. This is much more indirect, but it's getting at the same thing, this dialogue they have going down the mountains. The disciples do not want to talk about suffering and dying. They ask Jesus, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? In the book of Malachi, in our Bibles, the last book of the Old Testament, there was a prophecy that Elijah would return before the great day of the Lord, meaning this great day when God would appear and make everything right. Who'd they see on the mountain? Who'd they see on the mountain? Elijah. Elijah is here. And if Elijah is here, and you're the Messiah, day of the Lord, right? Enemies vanquished, triumphant victory, Israel restored, everything made right. Again, Peter's like, let's do this. Let's get on with it. And Jesus says, yeah, to be sure, Elijah does come. But then he gets this twist. Jesus says, yeah, Elijah's actually already come. He doesn't say it explicitly, but it's very clear. And the other gospel writers, I think they actually say it explicitly. He's talking about John the Baptist. John the Baptist was beheaded. John the Baptist suffered. So the disciples now are probably even more confused. The forerunner of the Messiah suffered. And now the Messiah is talking about suffering. This is really strange to them. Every time Jesus starts talking about death and suffering, the disciples basically freak out. This is not in their program. The high mountain air has not cleared their heads. They're confused. They're still stuck, as we've been talking about, in these old ways of thinking. They haven't unlearned it yet. They've seen the glory, and they've been given a foretaste of the glory. But now they got to come off the mountain. And now the conversation turns to suffering. This is the one place they do not want to go. Suffering, Jesus says, is not incompatible with greatness. In fact, Jesus is saying to them, the path to greatness, the path to glory, is actually through suffering. That these two things, glory and greatness and suffering, actually go hand in hand. Peter wants to prolong the glorious moment on the mountain, but he wants this conversation to just go away. Suffering is not in his program. Let's be honest. If we're totally honest, suffering is not in our program either. Most of us know, I think in our heads, suffering is part of life, that being a follower of Jesus does not exempt us from suffering. In theory, I think most of us get that. But in reality, when it happens, we tend to freak out. It's one thing to recognize that suffering is a part of life and discipleship in theory, but when it actually happens to us personally, we are thrown into confusion. We love mountaintop experiences. And don't get me wrong, mountaintop experiences have their place. They're important. They give us a foretaste of what is to come. When we make chocolate chip cookies in our house, one of the highlights is you get to taste the dough, right? Sometimes I think that foretaste is so good that that's all you want is the foretaste. Like you just want to sit there with the bowl and eat all the chocolate chip cookie dough, right? Anybody else? I just think it's so good. But you can't stop there. It's a foretaste. You gotta get them in the oven. If you've got little kids, that's a long time to wait the 15, 20 minutes before the cookies bake. There are moments in life where life is sweet. There are mountaintop experiences in sweetness and taste that we just want to prolong them. We want to preserve them. We want to stick them in our freezer for winter. But in reality, they're always fleeting. They're always followed by a descent off the mountain. Peter and his disciples have a foretaste of glory, of being over in the presence of glory, but also, I'm sure, surrounded by the loving presence of an almighty God. But ascents up mountains are always followed by descents. And the reality, as hard as it is for us to recognize, is that most all of life doesn't happen on the mountains, but in the valley, where the shadow of death hangs over us. And it's interesting, if you keep reading Mark, the next scene after the transfiguration, they get down off this mountain. A spirit's trying to violently kill this young boy. The disciples can't drive it out. A desperate father is saying, like, struggling with his unbelief in all this. When, if you remember Moses, he comes down, and what does he find? There's a golden calf, his brother Aaron, and the Israelites are crafting. It's like, welcome to the valley, right? Welcome to life. Jesus says, in this world, you have trouble. We hear those words coming down the mountain, but I think our instinct is to say, no. No, you're mistaken. Some may have trouble. Some may have trial. But some can avoid it too, right? Sometimes, let's be honest, we even hear people within our own Christian faith talk in this way, give us the impression that if we're suffering, well, maybe it's our own fault. I was working on this sermon this week, and I found myself thinking about one of my friends, my farmer friends from Illinois, lived right up the creek from me. And he, when we met, he hadn't attended church in a long time. He says, I forced him to come to our church to listen to me preach. That is not true at all. That's what he says. But he told me a story once. He did end up going to our church. He told me a story once. He said he was down south of where we were attending a church, and he heard a preacher giving a sermon. And the basic gist of the message was, if you have health issues, it's because there's sin in your life, and you are holding on to that sin. And if you just repented of that sin, you would have a long and healthy life. And then, so right in the middle of the service, he calls my friend, who was suffering from some pretty challenging health problems then and now, forward to confess the sins he must clearly have been hanging on to so he could be cured. This is a true story. My friend understandably didn't want to go up there, so the preacher asked him to go out into the corner of the church where an elder could pray for him. He found this embarrassing, to say the least. He quit going to that church. In fact, he just quit going to church altogether. When he told me the story many years later, I think the pain was still evident. Most of us in here, I hope, wouldn't be so crass or insensitive or have such bad and irresponsible theology as this preacher. But here's the deal. I think at least to some degree, this principle, this idea lurks in the back of our minds, probably more than we would like to admit. How do I know? Why? Because I know myself. The question, why? Why is this happening? Why am I suffering right now? I'm a good person. Why are bad things happening to me? Don't hear this as there's not space to ask the question why. Absolutely there is. In fact, Jesus from the cross says, my God, why have you forsaken me? The point of here is not that we can't ask why, that God can't handle that. My point is, for many of us, there's an unspoken belief that lurks in the back of our minds that if we can just follow biblical principles, and if there's not unrepentant sin in our lives, that life is supposed to go a certain way. Jesus says there's trouble coming, but we think we've found a way out of that. We have this kind of unspoken contract with God that as long as we keep our end of the bargain, God has to keep his end of the bargain. Here's the sober reality that Jesus is teaching here. Mountaintop experiences are great. They're important. They have a place in our lives, but they're episodic. They don't last. The question is not whether trouble and suffering and trial is going to come to you. That's a guarantee. Jesus says it to us. But, you know, most of us, it's 2020. We don't even need Jesus to tell us that trouble is coming, right? It was, 2020, all the bad things that are, bad time for a joke, bad time. The question is not whether we'll have trouble and suffering in this world. It's how are you going to respond to it? Is it going to drive you closer to God, or is it going to drive you away from God? Is it going to make you into a bitter person, or are you going to become more tender, more empathetic person? Are you going to pretend like this trouble doesn't exist, that it can just kind of go away and vanish? Or are you going to realize you got to go through it? We are like the disciples in so many ways. We are so glad to join Jesus up the ascent. It's on the descent. When Jesus reminds us that suffering and glory are intertwined, that we want to change the subject. We do not want to talk about this. Jesus won't change the subject. He begins at Peter's confession to talk about suffering, and now he's going to keep talking about it. He's going to keep talking about how suffering and glory are intertwined. But the disciples get two important things as they make this descent this down the mountain. How are they going to navigate the valley? As I said, if life is mostly in the valley, what do they get from this story to navigate? Well, first they get a vision. They get a foretaste. They get this bright, gleaming light to help them carry through the dark valleys that they know, that Jesus knows lies ahead. In moments of failure and opposition and suffering, it is easy to fall into despair. There are also, for some people, moments in life where there's this momentary breakthrough, where it might not last long, but the truth of who God is, this great love that God has for us, it breaks through and it shines in a very visible way. It might just be for a minute. It might just be for a few seconds. It's a mountaintop experience. And we can draw strength from those mountaintop experiences, from those visions. Our family recently finished watching the trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. If you know this, novel or the movies, you know that the story centers around a hobbit named Frodo, who is dispatched from his homeland, which is the Shire, which is this beautiful, green, lush place, on a mission with his friend Sam to destroy the One Ring by casting it into the fires of Mount Doom and thus saving Middle Earth. And this long quest, as carrying this ring takes a toll. Anybody who has the ring or touches the ring, it begins to take this really terrible toll. And Frodo has not been able to escape that. Towards the end of the story, Frodo is lying on the slopes of Mount Doom, where he has to take the ring to be destroyed. And at the end of his own fiery trial, lava is now spewing all around him. He is unable to go any further. And at that moment, Sam, ever faithful Sam, runs up and says to Frodo, "Do you remember the Shire, Mr. Frodo? It will be spring soon. The orchards will be in blossom, and the birds will be nesting, and the haze will thicken, and they'll be sowing summer barley in the lower fields and eating the first strawberries with cream. Do you remember the taste of strawberries? Do you remember the taste of strawberries?" Peter and his disciples on the mountain, they got a taste. And later on, experiencing their own trials and suffering, when I'm sure they were tempted to despair, Peter seems to draw power and energy from this moment on the mountain. He seems to have never forgotten what he experienced. In 2 Peter, we read this: "Were we eyewitnesses of his majesty, For he received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory, saying, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." Listen to this last line. "We ourselves heard the voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain." So Peter, he remembers what he saw. If you read Peter, you know there's lots of talk about fiery trials. So Jesus gives to Peter and James and John through this vision a sweet and powerful foretaste to help them carry them through the fiery trials, to remind them that glory is not incompatible with suffering, that the two go hand in hand. But the disciples don't get a vision, just get a vision. They get something else. They get a command. Listen to him. Even if we've had even if you've been blessed to have a mountaintop experience, often, usually, memory fades. Often you begin to even wonder, was that even real? Was that just a mirage? Was that just in my head? The mountaintop experience is important, but alone, it's very unlikely to sustain you for the long haul. But God gives them something else. He gives them instruction. Listen. Listen to him. If the mountaintop experience is episodic and fleeting and merely a foretaste, a sweet foretaste of what is to come, it is the word of the Lord that remains constant. It is the word of the Lord that is our bread for the journey. And that what we need if we are going to carry forward through the fiery trials of life. We must not feed on the lies of our culture, even the lies within our faith by some, that we can avoid suffering. No, we must feed on the word of the Lord. That is what will sustain us long after the tingly mountaintop experience and vision has faded. Listen to him. The same words spoken to the disciples are spoken to us today.